Welcome to another episode of Multiverse Musings. As always, I'm your host, Adam, and with me, for the second time, is my new co-host, Travis. Travis, how's it going?
Pretty good, Adam. How about you?
I'm doing well. We are getting close to Christmas. In fact, this will technically be our Christmas episode because it'll probably be the last one that posts before the Christmas holiday. And we have a little bit of a Christmas flavor to our episode today, and so we're going to skip our comic book recommendations because we are doing a mini comic book review this week.
Really fun comic kind of story. We'll get into that when we get to our review there.
Yeah, and we are speaking of being in December. We are now as of this recording, 5 days away from seeing Aquaman 4.
I'm seeing it on Saturday right now. It looks like at noon, and okay, with hopes of seeing it twice, by the end of the weekend.
Okay, cool. I'm seeing it Friday, we're less than a week away, which seemed almost impossible when we first started this countdown a while back. So it's pretty cool to think we're this close. And on that note, Aquaman is already, how can I put this? Well, I was going to try and not make a pun, but it's kind of unavoidable. Aquaman is already making waves at the box office, Travis.
It is killing it. It is straight killing it, Adam, especially over in China. That's where it really got the ball rolling.
Yeah, but so some of these projections are crazy. As of right now, 11 days into its run in China, it's sitting at 191 million, which beat Captain America Civil War. In fact, in China, it's beat all the solo Marvel character movies, like the solo MCU movies, which is insanity.
It's pretty crazy.
So now, in addition to China, it's open in 43 markets internationally as of the weekend that just went by. And so in those markets, it's collected a grand total of 131.3 million, which means internationally so far, as of this recording anyway, Aquaman is sitting at $266.4 million. That is insane.
That is very crazy. And it really opens up the possibility for this thing reaching Wonder Woman numbers, depending on how the domestic...
Oh, I think it's pretty much... Is. Yeah, I mean... Yeah, because, you know, some box office analysts are saying that it could hit 500 million globally by Christmas. So that's... I would have never expected these numbers for Aquaman, just because competition and the fact that, look, it's in terms of DC characters, it's Aquaman. He's a relative, I mean, he's, I wouldn't say an unknown, but, you know, Aquaman has not had the most favorable reputation over the years. So this film, I think, is changing it. And in terms of reviews, it's at 71%. I mean, look, to me, reviews don't matter. Whatever score it was, I would have seen it anyway, because it was on my radar. But people do seemingly care about Rotten Tomatoes. So as of right now, it's sitting at 71% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is pretty solid. You know, considering DC Films' track record, like the connected shared universe DC films, I think 71 is a solid number. And I think this is I think Aquaman is the first step in the sort of rehabilitation of the DC Films franchise.
Well, you know me, Adam, as a fan of the old DCEU as well. I personally don't put much stock into the Rotten Tomatoes score as much as the audience score. I have a few critics that I follow personally on Twitter, and I read their reviews, and because usually what they think of a movie, I think of as well, and our tastes usually align. I don't really follow the Met. I don't like the way they score things
sure,
there.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
But there are some really good and qualified critics on there. You can't argue against that. There are a lot of solid critics on there. But I just, there's ones that I have a personal, like, I think connection, maybe maybe a bit too much, but that's what I use as a good barometer for to go see a movie. That and audience score, I feel, is a little bit more of an indicator, because sometimes you can get certain things, like what we see with Venom, having such a terrible critic score, but being so good. So you can get, like you said, but that is still, for a DCEU movie, you're not wrong, that is a very positive score going into opening weekend. The one thing I wanted to throw to you for a question was, do you think with the success that DC has had with putting out Aquaman starting overseas and then coming to the US after, like this is the first time really that I can remember this happening for any comic book movie, is opening overseas and then opening in the States. I could be wrong. I'm sure our users will, our listeners will correct me on that. But I just want to know, do you think this might change your plan, and this might be something they might do a lot more going forward?
Well, I mean, it's worth looking into if you're Warner Brothers in DC, because if it were, I would at least consider it with Shazam and try it a second time to see if it works, and then if it again proves to be a successful format, why not? I would seriously, like I said, give it another test run with Shazam. And if that works out, then definitely I would. I mean, do whatever you can to maximize, word of mouth and then your profits, obviously. So, and then, as much as it might suck for us to have to wait while other people are seeing it first, I like to think of myself as having a little patience. So I think it'll be okay. I'll be okay. Whatever works best for the film, and if that's the strategy that Warner Brothers chooses going forward, I'm totally for it. Whatever continues the success of this franchise that holds, the characters that I love so much. So yeah, I'd definitely be down for that.
Awesome.
I guess we'll continue in terms of movie news, since we're, here on this topic. And one of the movies that's going into filming, I believe January 14th or 15th, just right at the first 2 weeks of the new year, is Birds of Prey. And last week, this was after we had recorded, Birds of Prey added to its cast, and that is Chris Messina is joining Birds of Prey as Batman bad guy Victor Zsasz. Some of the trades have been reporting that this is Zsasz's first appearance in a live-action film. That's incorrect. He was briefly in Batman Begins. Remember the guy that had the...
He was the one that Crane wanted to experiment on in Arkham, yeah.
Yeah, with the cut marks, that sort of...
Well, that was his calling card.
And
all his cuts were all the kills that he's made.
Right. And in this film, I guess he's going to be working for or with Black Mask. And so, I think it's a cool addition to the Rogues Gallery for the Birds of Prey to battle in this film. What about you?
I think this is a good idea, especially for a rated R Birds of Prey movie. I don't know how much control Black Mask will have of Victor Zsasz, as we both know how insane he is.
Yeah, he's a wild, sure.
We've seen him in Gotham.
Yes.
Right, a nice bit, so we do have familiarity with him. He's in the Arkham games as well. I think he's one of the first bosses there that I love the games. I just had to mention it. I think just smart. They're just bringing in, this is a B, C level Batman villain, so somebody you can pull. And I just think that I haven't seen him in anything really. He has been in Argo, is the only thing that I remember him from.
Yeah, so he worked with current / probably former Batman Ben Affleck. So yeah, it's kind of interesting, that connection. But yeah, it's like I said, you know, to me, the important thing is not to start killing off your villains, which was one of the mistakes of the Burton Schumacher era. Because, you know, the idea that they might show up, or there's at least a possibility of them showing up in future Batman films, is nice. Whether they do or don't is another thing. So that's my only caution. Don't go killing, you know, the bad guys. But other than that, yeah, I mean, it'll be cool to see Victor Zsasz again. And like you said, he's perfect for a R-rated toned movie. So, and you know me, I've been looking forward to Birds of Prey for since it was announced. And the fact that we're so close to starting filming here is an exciting proposition for me.
I believe one of your things you'll hope for in the new year is as much information as possible about that.
I love that. I mean, without spoiling the whole movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The same way Joker is for the Todd Phillips movie, where we get a lot of cool shots, but we still don't know nothing about the movie. I think that's the kind of thing you might be hoping for.
Oh, I definitely want, you know, remember when Suicide Squad released the first picture of the cast and costume?
Yeah.
I definitely want that. That's what I want. An official shot.
Oh, for sure. Especially of the Birds of Prey. Yeah, you're right there. That would be amazing.
Yeah, so that's what I'm hoping for more than anything. And I hope we get it before they start shooting on the street so that we get a clear, you know, high-definition shot as opposed to cell phone cameras and stuff. So that's, but yeah, I'm excited for the casting and can't wait to see this movie go through the filming process in the new year. Why don't we head to TV, or more specifically, streaming? And there's a lot of news where that's concerned. So first, because most of this is Stargirl related, I'm going to do the non-Stargirl related news first. And that is that former 90210 and Sharknado alum Ian Ziering joins the cast of Swamp Thing as DC hero Blue Devil. Now, I was happy about this news, not because I'm a huge connoisseur of all things Blue Devil, but Andy DiGenova from Holy Badcast loves Blue Devil. And he's wanted to see Blue Devil in live action. Like every time I listen to this, since I started listening to that podcast, he's mentioned Blue Devil, I don't know how many times, so, you know, his love of Blue Devil. So when I heard this news, I was happy, but more and more so, I was happy for him, if that makes sense. But I think it's cool that, you know, Swamp Thing is pulling, you know, I call them the deep cuts, you know, and really going deep into the DC library and pulling out somebody like Blue Devil for this show. And he's more, you know, mystical, one of the mystical heroes, so it makes sense to use him in Swamp Thing. And I know of Ian Ziering's work, so it'll be interesting to see how they pull that off. Look, the DC streaming service so far has not given me anything to worry about in terms of the look of characters and such and that sort of thing. So I'm on board with this. I am totally on board with it. I'm looking forward to it. It's a character, like I said, I'm not very familiar with, but the little bit that I do know, I'm excited to see him in live action. What about you? What are your thoughts on this?
I echo the same sentiments as you, because I'm a loyal listener to the Holy Batcast. Listened to them for quite some time. They have a pretty cool two-parter with the DC TV Squadcast about Elseworlds. I recommend our listeners give that a listen. It's great. And I thought that someone should have called at least the paramedics to go check on Andy, because I thought that he might have passed out at the very least. But I'm excited. I don't know much about this character. I'm not a big Swamp fan reader. I'm going to have to start now before the show and catch up. But I'm like I said, I'm not really familiar with Ian Ziering's work either. I don't think I've seen a single Sharknado, a couple clips maybe. And I don't, the 90210, I didn't watch. I was too busy watching Batman the Animated Series and stuff like that growing up rather than 90210.
Yeah. My 90210 was my sister's thing, whereas I was watching, so it was on because she was watching.
Oh yeah, you got it like that. I'm the oldest of my family, so
yeah. I'd be watching, Batman Animated Series, and then she'd be watching, 90210. So
she'd come in and turn it off on you. But no, I'm pretty excited. I think just more casting news for this stuff. Like you said about DC, I've thoroughly enjoyed Titans. I thought they hit it out of the park so far. So, especially with the guest people they've had on certain episodes, basically come out from the story, a little standalone thing. They've nailed each one, all the characters. So I think that they'll do nothing but the same with Swamp Thing. And knowing James Wan is involved as executive producer, we'll get some horror elements in there. And I'm just going to have to start reading to learn more about Iron Theory's character.
Yeah, I'll give you some recommendations as that gets close.
That's awesome. Thanks, bud.
Because I've read some Swamp Thing. So.
That's one thing I haven't read anything of, the Swamp Thing, and I think I'm going to have to dive into that.
I think you'll enjoy it. I really do.
I'm pretty sure I will, too, yeah.
All right, so continuing on in the DC Universe streaming service arena, let's switch over to Stargirl because there's a lot of casting surrounding that. And we've known that the JSA would be present in this Stargirl show. Like, she'll be the center, but the JSA is going to be present. And so, as a result, we are now getting casting announcements for the actors that will fill out the roles of the JSA members. The first one that came out last week was that actor Joel McHale has been cast as Starman. Now, from my understanding, this actor is a more of a comedic actor.
Yes, I'm very familiar with him. If any of our listeners have watched Community, it's a pretty good streaming site. He's been around since almost the start of Netflix. He was pretty funny on there. That's where he pretty much got his fame. That and The Soup, a little like talk show thing with clips. But
right.
I know him pretty well. He is more of a comedic actor. So this casting is strange for me. One place you might know him from, this is not DC related, but in Spider-Man 2, he's the guy that Aunt May kicks when she's trying to get a loan in the bank when Dr. Octopus is.
Okay.
That's him. That was one of his first roles, but that was before he caught fame. But that was the start. That was him in the comic book world. So.
Oh, that's cool. And look, here's the thing about Starman, or at least from what I know from my JSA reading, he's not a very dark or tortured hero. He's more upbeat and uplifting. So I think in that respect, there's nothing alarming about casting a comedian.
No, this seems like a perfectly good casting then.
Or someone that's more known to doing comedy. So I have no issues with that. The next member of the JSA that was cast was Lou Ferrigno Jr. as Our Man. Now, everybody knows Lou Ferrigno. And, his son, to use a Hulk sort of reference, is leaping over to the DC Universe to play Our Man. And I think, I've seen Lou Ferrigno Jr. He's in that show, SWAT, the reboot of the show SWAT. For DC fans, SWAT stars former Birds of Prey star Shamar Moore. So if you watch Birds of Prey, you'll know who Shamar Moore is. Anyway, notice I didn't yell Birds of Prey alum with capital letters implied. Or anything like that. But anyway, I think it's cool to have, the son of the actor that played the Incredible Hulk on this on this show. I mean, he's got the look for it for sure. And like I said, what I've seen of him in SWAT, he's pretty solid. So as an actor, so I'm cool with his casting. I think it's kind of legacy casting, even though it's comic book legacy casting and not DC legacy casting, but still, I'm down with it. And again, if you look at the Alex Ross drawing of Iron Man and look at Lou Ferrigno Jr.'s chin, because you know the image of the character in Alex Ross's drawing is got his hood and the mask and all that stuff. But if you look at the chin of Lou Ferrigno Jr. and you look at the chin on the Iron Man designed by Alex Ross, it's a good look. He's got the matching chin, so there you go. What are your thoughts on this?
I think that it's right in line with most of the DCU's casting. Can you tell me anybody on Titans that you remember before Titans? Because I can't remember any of them in anything. Really, well, Hacking Dog, because I've seen them in other things. Yeah. I'm just talking about the main cast.
The main Titans, the only one I knew was Brenton Thwaites from Pirates of the Caribbean, the most recent one.
There you go. So, still a relatively newcomer, and that seems to be what they've done minus Joe McHale in this show as well.
Yeah, I think they seem to be going for, you know, solid actors, but not like crazy well-known.
No, usually giving them their breaks on the show, potentially. And like you said, I'm looking right now at the group, Facebook group, the Multiverse Musings Facebook group. The picture you have right up alongside, and that's a perfect shot. And I'm just going into this with open mind, and we'll see if I'm sure he can act better than his father.
Well, hey, listen, I think he was great as the Incredible Hulk. No, I don't mean that in a bad way. Look, I'll take his Incredible Hulk over I'll take his Lou Ferrigno's Incredible Hulk over what is the guy playing
in Banner now?
No, the guy playing it right now in the Avengers,
Mark Ruffalo.
Yeah.
Whoa.
I'll take Lou Ferrigno's Hulk over that, because I think they've turned, I mean, we'll save this for the Marvel podcast, but I think they've turned, since the Avengers movie, after that, they've turned the Hulk into a joke. And, but that's, like I said, that's not this podcast, it's another podcast.
But is that really Bruce Banner or Mark Ruffalo's fault, or is that on the
Hulk? Well, it is, because he's doing the voice, and even Banner is the butt of the jokes, too. Like, he's a joker now. And it's like, I'm not a particular fan of that. But again, we'll discuss
We'll get back on topic.
Yeah. We'll discuss that more when the time is right. But more JSAers have been added to the cast.
Yeah.
The next one up is, let's see here.
Wildcat, I think?
Yes, Wildcat, that's right. And the actor playing him is Brian, how do you pronounce that? Staff, I guess.
Staff, I would say the P is silent, maybe.
Yeah, that's all I would assume. Wildcat's one of my favorites in terms of JSA members. Like, I love Wildcat. The whole idea of like the boxer, the backstory of the boxer. You know, he's kind of like a Batman in the JSA team, you know, the group, and you know he teaches a lot of them how to fight and stuff, and so yeah, I'm a fan of this guy, of this character, and I think. I mean, we've seen Ted Grant, which is the alias of Wildcat. But we've seen him on Arrow. But that was one of the I don't even know what to call that, because I thought the portrayal of Wildcat and Arrow was terrible.
I'm holding in my breath, waiting for you to finish so I can come in hot on this one.
But for anybody wondering where or if they've seen Brian Staff before, he's been in The Purge, the TV series on USA. He's been on the CW in the short-lived show Valor, and he was also on several episodes of The Walking Dead. He's also worked as a stunt performer, and which I think will be great for any of the action sequences that he has to be part of. So that's cool. So yeah, I love that they're bringing in again the Wildcat character, because I love the character from the JSA comics, and so I couldn't be more thrilled with this. And again, look wise, I think this actor's got a good look for it. All right, so unleash with your thoughts on Wildcat.
Well, I'm super happy that they're doing Wildcat. I'm hoping that they're going to do him justice. With the DC universe, I have no reason to think that they won't, and they won't take the character serious. I loved him in the comics. He's trained multiple characters, including Black Canary, Green Arrow, Batman. He's had, like, throughout the history of the DC comics, he was Wicket. I really enjoyed him in the Justice League Unlimited animated run. He had a nice little story there about him getting older and dealing with that and being in a fight club. That was fantastic. And then we get to his Arrow portrayal, which was, in a word, a hot dumpster fire. The character,
that's more than one word, but yeah, I get what you're saying.
The character is terrible. The way that he barely trained... He barely trained Black Canary for 2 weeks, and she's fighting League of Assassin members like she's Green Arrow. I don't get that, especially considering the Green Arrow in this show destroyed him every chance he got, including shooting him with a boxing glove arrow. I didn't like the portrayal. Maybe it goes more with how I didn't enjoy Laurel Lance in that show. We're gonna go. That will be a different tangent entirely. But I'm really excited for this. Like you said, this guy's a relative newcomer to me. But if you're saying that he has a stunt background, that's even better. I think from what we've seen so far in the streaming service app, they don't spare any expense on fight scenes. And I've been really happy with especially Robin's fight scenes in Titans. So I think Wildcat is even better true martial artist. So hopefully we'll really get to see him. And hopefully he's a bit younger than... And I'm really excited, like you said. He's one of my favorite JSA characters, and I can't wait to see him done justice.
Cool. Yeah, I'm in total agreement with you. I mean, I love the Arrowverse, as you're going to find out, you know, in a bit. But one of the failings that they had, I mean, one of the failings, especially with Arrow, I think one of the failings of Arrow was the way they portrayed Wildcat. I thought that was weak. And in terms of your comment about how they handled Laurel and her capacity for fighting is spot on. I think, but they've done that with all the characters. So like Roy, you know, he learned how to fight in what? A couple of days, a couple of weeks.
I'll just interject there for a second. I'll argue a bit for Roy, because they brought him along slowly in the second.
Yeah, okay, a little slower, yeah.
Even in the third season, when they're fighting in the crossover Brave and the Bold, they're fighting Captain Boomerang, and he gets knocked down and loses his batons in a matter of seconds, and Oliver's left to fight him alone for a solid 30 more seconds. He's taken out. So at least they showed him a few times. Same thing with when he fought the Atom electrocuted him and shot him away in a matter of seconds. So he was basically nothing. So at least they kept him a little bit grounded in terms of, but you're going to go out with more characters, and I'm going to agree with you because your overall premise with the way they handle some of these characters is spot on.
Yeah. So both of us are looking forward to Wildcat, and we've got one more JSA to discuss, and that is Dr. Midnight. And Dr. Midnight will be played, but let's see here. Let me pull it up. We've got, you're on the Facebook. Who's the actor here?
Okay.
We've got.
It doesn't have the.
Main actor. Yeah, that's right. I was looking for. Hold on. Here it is. It's in the headline. It wasn't in there. Unlike the other ones, it wasn't in the headline.
Henry Thomas.
There we go. I looked at this. I mean, all it says is that he was in the Haunting of Hill House, which I've never seen, so I'm not too familiar with this guy. But you know, the description of the character as a brilliant and forward-thinking medical pioneer and a founding member of the JSA. He's basically described as team's doctor and a detective. So he essentially Batman with medical skill, which I'm cool with. But yeah, like I said, I've gotten to the point where I will trust the casting director on this and give it the benefit of the doubt. What about you?
I echo your sentiments. I don't know him from much, but I'm just excited with all this casting news. It's just, they're ramping up on Stargirl. I'm assuming because they're pretty much finished with Doom Patrol, and Swamp Thing is already on the go, so they need their next show.
Apparently, from what I understand, Stargirl starts filming in February. So,
yeah, I assume that'll be their next live action after Swamp Thing.
Yeah, so that's why we're getting all this news fast and furious now. So
I love it.
So, but the more news, the better. Yeah. All right, so that's it for the news portion. So let's move into, like I said, we weren't going to do our comic book recommendation in the normal way because we're doing a little bit of a comic book review. And the book we're reviewing is Batman Noel. And obviously by the title, you can tell it has a Christmas, you know, theme to it. And so this book is written and drawn by artist Lee Bermejo. He's done the artwork for the Joker graphic novel and for the Lex Luthor Man of Steel graphic novel. And it's basically a take on one of my favorite Christmas stories, A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, but featuring the Batman mythology. So, because you've read this, this is your first time reading it, Travis. What were your thoughts on it?
I really enjoyed this, Adam. I'm kind of hesitant to call it a comic, because it had more of a storybook vibe to me, like just like the Christmas Carol. I was apprehensive at first when I found out Batman was the Scrooge character.
Yeah.
But the way they did it, it totally paid off for me. I enjoyed the three spirits he was visited by, but majorly I enjoyed his interactions with Superman. That was the highlight of the story for me. And even the way they drawed out Batman was, the illustrations was fantastic. And it made me even want to know more about this universe. Which Robin was that died on him? Because it kind of looked awful lot like Dick.
I think they kept it as is, so I think it's decent. Yeah. It's just the way the artist draws it looks like,
the way they draw it, it looked awful lot like Dick from that, which made me like, even be like, what's going on here? I want to know more. So I just loved it from head to toe. And I thought that this is another great thing you can share with your kids. Not quite super young, but like to 10 to 12 to 14 year range that could get a bit of fun out of this. I thought this was a great little read, especially for families.
Yeah, I think it was definitely jarring when you read it to see Batman propositioned as the Scrooge character, because we think of Batman, you know, predominantly as a hero. We typically as fans never look at him in a sort of negative light like we did in the Scrooge story. But I think it works. And what I loved about this was that, you know, here we're seeing Batman. We've never really seen Batman ill, like sick or struggling from like a human ailment, such as, you know, a cold, or in this case, the starting of pneumonia or whatever. And I thought that was cool because I think we've only seen it in the animated series. So anytime I see it, it's like, oh, you know, they're reminding us that Batman is indeed human, right? Which is nice. I love the idea of positioning, you know, certain characters as like the ghost of Christmas past, present, and future in this story. So like, obviously you mentioned Jason Todd. He's the ghost of the Jacob Marley ghost that we associate with the original story. Then you have Catwoman as the ghost of Christmas past, who sort of, you know, takes Batman through their you know, nostalgia and the good old days when they used to chase each other on rooftops and such. Then you have Superman, who is the ghost of Christmas present, you know, the more jolly one. Although the ghost of Christmas present in the story is quite hefty, yeah, jolly individual. Superman is, you know, Superman is fit and all that. But, and his whole purpose is to show Batman that there are good people in Gotham, because Batman's whole avenue of getting at the Joker is tracking down one of his henchmen named Bob. I don't know if that's a nod. I mean, obviously it's a nod to Bob Cratchit from the original story, but maybe it's a nod to Bob. You remember the henchman from Batman 89? I personally took it to be a nod to that. I don't know if you saw that or if I'm just...
I thought the same thing, actually.
Okay, good. So, Superman's trying to show them that there are good people in Gotham, and that, you know, he's so hell-bent on using Bob and putting Bob in a threatening situation just to get to the Joker, that, you know, all Bob is doing is trying to provide for his family and his son, right? So, yes, he made the wrong decision, but he's not a criminal on the Joker's level. And throughout the story, there are moments where Batman takes it too far with Bob. So I think that's what Superman was trying to, you know, impart on him. And then getting the scene where the Joker is the ghost of Christmas future, right? And you see him trying to, he throws Batman in the grave and tries to sort of like bury him alive and stuff. That was like visually, that was some cool stuff. Like the art in this, like Lee Bermejo is becoming one of my favorite artists in comics and graphic novels. So I loved it. I just the fact that this, like I said, what you're doing is you're merging my favorite Christmas story with one of my top two favorite comic book superhero characters. How can that be anything but a win?
It basically shows the staying power of these characters, because they can be placed in any medium, in any story, and they can be relatable.
And there's even one real like poignant message in the book's finale, which is, you know, at one point Bob manages to grab the Joker's gun and holds the Joker at gunpoint, right? But you see Batman convincing Bob to say, you know, don't do it. Show your son you're the better man that I know you are. And so the fact that Batman was able to talk him down and get through to him, it kind of reminded me, remember that moment in Suicide Squad where Batman apprehended Deadshot?
Yeah, and his child talked him down.
Yeah, it was very similar in that respect.
And the good thing about, and a nice thing about that is we see Batman change over the story. We know that the Batman at the start of the story wouldn't have talked him down, really.
Yeah.
Because we hear him say a couple times, just to get rid of another of the criminal population here in Gotham. So I don't think he would tell him not to do that. So we see the evolution of him throughout the story, which was nice to see.
Yeah, much like the Scrooge story does, right? So I thought,
yeah.
Again, the book is great. It stays true to the original material, but obviously imbues it with Batman mythology. And I think it's going to be a tradition, or it has been since it came out, that I read it every year around Christmas time, along with rewatching Batman Returns, which is my favorite Christmas movie. So I love this book. I if you haven't read it, I recommend it. I recommended it to Travis, and he said, let's, you know, because I had always planned on reviewing this here. And then he said, yeah, let me read it and we'll do it. So, I recommended to Travis, I recommended to all of our listeners. We just give you a brief little review as part of our comic recommendations for Christmas. And I hope you will seek it out and make it part of your Christmas / holiday traditions, because I just think it's wonderful. Travis, if you had to rate this, what would you rate it?
I'd definitely give it a solid 4 out of 5. Thought that it was great. Just don't go into it looking for much action. That's not what this is about. This is just an adaptation of a great story. And I thought that if you have any sort of knowledge of the DC universe, you'll love this. You'll love how each of the ghosts are a different character for Batman. And just like you said, seeing Batman being normal, Catherine, and that. And it was just a really great story, Adam. And I think I'm glad that we reviewed this on the podcast, because it's the first time I got to read it, and I couldn't be more happy.
Yeah. And I'll give it a A+, 5 out of 5, 10 out of 10, however you want to phrase it. I think it's great. Like I said, I love it, and it's become a part of my holiday tradition. So check it out. Why don't we get into the main discussion then, which was we've now seen the much talked about, much hyped three-night crossover within the Arrowverse titled Elseworlds. They shifted the schedule around. Flash aired first, followed by Arrow, and then it all ended with Supergirl. Travis, why don't you start us off? What'd you think?
I really enjoyed this crossover, Adam. There are some story mistakes / things you can nitpick. I thought this was more fan service than a cohesive story throughout the whole universe. But what we did get, I really enjoyed. I thought the main thing about this was Oliver and Barry, their interactions, the way they interacted between each other, the way they were each other's characters. I think Stephen Amell deserved a great round of applause for showing his comedic chops. He's not normal. He don't normally do that in Arrow, but I've seen it in a few episodes of New Girl, and he seemed to have good comedic timing there. And we see him fully embrace the Flash, and I really enjoyed that. We get a lot of fan service. We get some really cool characters. The Monitor was a really highlight for me. I thought the guy nailed him. And we get some fan service. Maybe not as much as we would have liked. We'll get into that with my complaints about John Wesley Shipp's Flash. But overall, I really enjoyed this crossover. And especially after at the end, the last thing we see, it's even more enjoyable because we know that this is just built up towards something even bigger.
Yeah, and we're going to get into spoilers. So if you haven't seen it yet, go ahead and watch and then come back and listen to this portion of the podcast.
I think that was a pretty good non-spoiler breakdown for myself. I wasn't even sure about that first.
Yeah, no, I personally loved it. I thought it really embraces its place in the comic book genre. Like, it's more, you know, it was more focused on, as a comic book story, if you took this as just a comic book story, it'd be a success. Because, and I think, like I said, this one, whereas Crisis on Earth X was more of an emotional story. Like, it hits you emotionally. This one is more so about embracing its comic book roots and just having fun with it. And so they're different animals, but I love them, you know, to the same extent. So now I want to go right in and go over the spoiler wall, as it were. So here we go. You talked about, Travis, the you know, Steve, the Freaky Friday / Quantum Leap aspect of, you know, them taking over each other's identities. By the way, I like the fact that the characters actually refer to Quantum Leap and Freaky Friday in the episode. That was a cool, you know, meta moment, if you will. But you're right. Stephen Amell never really gets to have fun as Oliver Queen. So seeing him do that as Barry Allen was a real treat. And on the flip side, you know, Grant Gustin is more of the playful, upbeat hero. So to see him dig down to places where he has to get a little darker was unique too, and I think it tested both actors' capabilities, because they both had to, in a sense, play each other. Like, they had to mimic each other's personalities and such. And so I thought it showed some quite a bit of range on both actors' parts. I love the fact that he blames, you know, when Oliver first wakes up as Barry, and it, like, watching his reaction to Iris kissing him was priceless. I couldn't stop laughing. But then when he uses the ring and gets in the suit, I thought it was hilarious, because he looks in the mirror and all he says is, "Barry, what have you done this time?" Right? Which that's become the go-to thing, which is whenever something goes wrong and one of these crossovers is a necessity, blame Barry, because he probably screwed something up in the timeline. So that was fun. And it was also fun to see, like, when they had to make their first rescues as the opposite hero. That was fun, because it seemed to me like Barry, as Oliver, adapted much quicker than Oliver did to being Barry and having super speed. And how they teased each other back and forth, like how they weren't used to each other's abilities, if you will. That was fun. That was like the humor of it all, which I like, because you know, that added to the episodes. You mentioned John Wesley Shipp. The episode starts off, they re-show the end tag from last week's episodes, which we had already discussed. So all they showed was that, and then we see John Wesley Shipp a little bit later on. But you know, when the cool thing is that when they do the body swap, nobody believes it. They're even put in the, you know, the Star Labs containment facility, because
a prison, Adam.
A prison, yeah. Because Iris doesn't believe him, Team Flash doesn't believe him. So, but then, you know, with some mushy dialogue and you know, Barry as Oliver, you know, so sorry, but yeah, Barry, actual Barry says some lines of dialogue of her that convinces him that they're legit in what they're saying. So once they get out of confinement, their big solution is, well, let's go over to Supergirl's Earth and see if she can help us out.
I'm going to touch on two scenes before you jump to Smallville.
Yeah.
When Stephen Amell's getting checked out as Barry and asks if he has a brain tumor and is like, can we cut it out on the PDA? It's not good at work.
So. Oh, yeah, which is what I've said watching. And like, they play with that about, you know.
Yeah, well, Cisco hugs him and... Ralph's like, you say it's your expression of love is touching or something like that.
Yeah.
And he's just like, I need to go home. I need to get out of here.
Yeah.
Which I thought was hilarious. And in the pipeline, the whole them using each other's powers and Oliver saying that line of, I was in prison for a while, for 5 months, and no matter how bad it got, and it got bad, there was always a toilet. And then they explain how they use the washroom, which has been a running question on the Flash.
Yeah.
So those are two things I really enjoyed.
Yeah, I like the fact that they took our complaints and sort of, or a lot of people's complaints, and put them into the...
And you have failed the city in the Arrow.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
Flash costume is just Ron.
Yeah, and it was hilarious. and the fact that when Oliver Asbury tries to throw the lightning bolt...
It kind of gets the job done, but it...
He gets the job done because he's trying to prevent the robbery at Ivo Labs, right?
Yeah.
But he hits some electrical equipment and sort of awakens a sleeping Amazo, which I didn't even know was going to be in the episode when I first watched it.
I thought... We seen a poster of that and showed that robot, and I thought it was the Anti-Monitor, so...
Yeah, nobody thought it was Amazo, yeah.
No, that was awesome.
So that was a nice surprise, but we'll get to more on him later.
Yeah,
because when Barry / Oliver leaves the Ivo Labs, like Amazo's hidden, so you don't need so Oliver / Barry. I'm gonna call him Oliver every time.
Oliver.
Yeah, they he doesn't see him. So we do, but all, the main characters don't at that point. So they open a breach. Going back to what I said, they open a breach and they head to Earth 38. Now, as they're going through the breach, the Smallville theme of Save Me begins playing. And when they come out the other side, we see Smallville, Kansas, and it's the same like shot that would open the Smallville theme song. Just, you know, looks a little brighter and all that stuff. And next thing you know, we're on the Kent Farm, which is which has been the much talked about, that they use the same Kent Farm from the Smallville TV show for this. And I thought using the Smallville theme, using that little show, the little like the wide shot that was in the show's intro of Smallville back then. I thought those were nice little touches to acknowledging the show that made the Arrowverse possible, because without Smallville, none of this would be happening. I maintain. So I thought that was nice. What did you think?
I agree with you completely. When that song kicked in, I was smiling. I thought it was a great little nod. And we don't know what we'll see going forward for future crossovers, so perhaps we'll actually see something from the Smallville universe. But even if we don't, that was a nice little nod they did there. And it brings us right into Superman, Clark, and Lois.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to get your thoughts on them.
Well, I love their dynamic, first of all, because... So, they're like, Superman, the way he's been presented before, has been doing this for a while, right? So now we get him and Lois that are together, and it seems like they've been together for a while. They have this rapport going on. They talk about their lives as reporters, like they're arguing over, you know, whether, not arguing, but they're debating whether Lois should publish a story. And they explain where Superman's been all this time. And that is, he took Lois to Argo to check out what Argo was like, right? So, for the first time, really, in this universe, Superman's experiencing what life on what remains of Krypton was actually like, right? So Lois has this bigger thing about, you know, I'm the first woman to ever step foot on, so Earth woman, to step foot on what was sort of is the remains of Krypton. And she wants to write a story about it, and Clark's trying to, you know, advise her not to. And then, so they get Supergirl, Kara's opinion, and she sides with Lois, right? And so, but all that banter between Clark and Lois, to me, was, it felt like reading the current comics, because there's, like, they have that shorthand, and they have that experience, and they have that, you know, togetherness. But the way, like, the way they interacted, the way they looked at each other, the little looks as Lois was walking away, or the way Clark would talk about Lois to Kara. I mean, we've only seen them together for this episode at this point. And yet, it feels like a real, legitimate, loving relationship.
I would agree with that, Adam. I felt like the limited time that we had with them, they showed a great chemistry. I think they played off each other quite well with, like you said, the little interactions between them. The whole thing when Lois is, like, climbing up the ladder, and Clark's like, be careful, and she just looks at him and says, like, you'll catch me if I fall. Like, that just sums up their dynamic pretty well. And I just really enjoyed Superman, especially in this first episode. I thought he was used fantastically. There's only a couple lines of dialogue I didn't really enjoy from Superman, but that's not until the third episode.
Yeah, that comes. Yeah, we have the same complaint.
Yeah,
I think.
I think so.
But one of the cool things that I'm going to say something, and then you tell me what you think. So, in terms of Clark and Lois and their banter, okay, I thought, like, to me, Bitsy Tulloch as Lois was sort of had the. She was a mix of Margot Kidder and Terry Hatcher. Did you sense that?
In her voice? I got a feeling of that more than Erica Durant.
Yeah, and I think it was. I think it's a good mix because she has that. You know, she's sort of in love with Clark because she's Superman and whatever. But in terms of the sass and the attitude and the drive as a reporter, I thought that was more that was more Terry Hatcher than Margot Kidder.
Agreed.
So I really liked her performance. I think she's a great Lois Lane.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, especially for someone that is already supposed to be established. And like, this is not a Lois that we're going to grow with, like in Smallville. This is a Lois that's already established.
Right, exactly.
I thought that she nailed that quite well.
Exactly. So, eventually, Oliver and Barry breach in, right? Apparently on Earth 38, nothing has changed because Kara recognizes Barry as Barry and Oliver as Oliver, except for their abilities have swapped. So now, there's a cool gag where Barry's trying to, or Oliver's trying to train Barry to be a better archer and whatnot. So they set up that test that Oliver did for Barry's speed from the season one crossover. And they redo it, but it's reversed. Remember the gag where Oliver shoots the arrows and Barry caught it, but then he got hit by the automatic arrows.
The green arrow fan in me will point out that Oliver did that to show Barry that he should just case his environment. Barry did it just for vengeance / to get a joke.
Sure, so. But it was still a funny moment.
Very funny.
The callback was a funny moment.
Well, I'm pretty positive they used the exact same footage of those two crossbows going off because the grass on the Smallville farm was awful green, and the grass that those two got shot at was brown, just like the Flash versus Arrow scene. I matched them up, and I'm pretty positive they just used the exact same footage.
I could see that.
Yeah. So, save time and money for more special effects.
Exactly, and there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
So, and I like the fact that through their bickering and constant, you know, like friendly arguing, let's call it, they learn something about each other, and they learn that to take on qualities from one another, like take a little bit of each other going for, like, I like that it was a learning moment for both of them, even though they were constantly, you know, arguing and bickering.
Oh, I agree. Well, we get a good moment. It's not until the second episode, but they are in each other's costumes, and they're like, Barry, Oliver's like, I thought that you had it easy, Barry. Everyone liked you, and everything was sunny, and you were just zipping around, and I realized that you have a lot more on your plate. And Barry says the same thing, saying, I don't think I could carry the burdens that you've had to carry. And I just thought, like you said, that was a great moment, and just fan service for us that before this year started, we had 230-odd hours from this Arrowverse.
Yeah.
And it's just like Barry and Oliver's relationship is one of the high points of this universe. Yeah. And it just pays off for us to have been watching it since season one.
So, yeah, Cisco breaches in, tells them about Amazo. So everybody volunteers to go, right? All the heroes that are there. And Cisco goes, who are you? Referring to Superman. And he rips open his shirt to reveal the Superman S. And he says, a friend, you know, so they're repurposing the line from Superman the movie. I thought that was great. It was a great usage of it. And for me, it was nice to see an actor using that Ken Farm, rip open his shirt and have a real costume underneath, unlike Tom Welling, who had a CGI t-shirt underneath for his final shirt rip.
Yeah, that was a very nice thing to see. And it's also nice, when he done that, I was like, you'll fit in well on this show, Superman. You clearly don't care about your secret identity.
Yeah. Well, he's on the farm. So
I know, I'm just playing because Cisco was there. He didn't know who Cisco was, and he just was like, yeah, Superman. I know Superman doesn't know it. I just thought that was really funny, that's all.
Yeah, that was kind of funny.
Yeah.
So they go back, and then we have the big battle with Amazo. And I got to tell you, man, that's something I never thought I'd see in live action. Like, even though all the stuff we've gotten, like, through movies and TV, still that's something I thought was only reserved for comic books and cartoons. But we got it. And I love the fact that pretty early on, Superman, like, flies in with both fists clenched and just delivers this super punch that knocks Amazo, like, actually into the ground. And I thought that was a great entrance for the world's greatest superhero.
Yeah, they did him justice there, I'll agree.
And so then, but then, as we know, Amazo, right, he appropriates the powers of the people he fights.
Well, he's already had the powers of Ralph, so the elongated man, so yeah. That smack would hurt him, but eventually he would recover like he does.
Yeah, but now, so now, as they're fighting him, he's gaining Barry's speed, Oliver's proficiency with the bowl, all of Superman and Supergirl's powers. And he fights back and gets right back at them, and he takes them all out. But I love the way our heroes adapted and sort of worked together. And in those moments, they each got a moment to shine. So, like, Supergirl and Superman were distracting him at first. And then you see, I think it was Superman and Superman and who was it? Barry? Or Oliver as Barry? Holding him down?
All three of them.
Yeah.
Were holding him down, yeah.
And then Barry as Green Arrow shoots him with an arrow that has a virus inside. So that takes him out. So what I loved about it was that each hero got to have their moment, but at the end of the day, it was the Flash and Green Arrow that saved the day, as it should be, because the Arrowverse started with them, so I thought it was a nice touch.
That was great. I agree with you completely. I love that scene, and we got a little nod to Crisis on Earth X, because Amazo chases Barry Bolivar to the place that they had to rebuild in the Crisis crossover. On the fly while it's falling down, and he freezes all that, and we see him running across that structure. I thought that was pretty cool, and a little mad there.
Yeah, and so before we end the first part, we see, so when all that's done, they're back in Star Labs. They're back in Star Labs, and Sisko gets a vision. And so he's vibing, and he sees the monitor and John Deegan, who is the monitor's sort of proxy, right?
Yeah.
The monitor's given the book to, that's altering, which is the cause of the altering of the realities. So he has a vibe of them too, and he's describing it to Barry / Oliver, and he's drawing it. And what we see is the two of them with the book in Gotham City. And the reason why we know it's Gotham City is because we see the Wayne Tower in the background. And so Oliver says, well, we gotta go, we're going to Gotham City. The cool thing about that drawing, Travis, I don't know if you know this, but that was actually drawn by Jim Lee.
Yes, I do. That was a fantastic little nod. He's done the same a couple times in Arrow. In the pilot, or in the second episode, I think it was the pilot, there's a little wanted ad for a Green Arrow.
Oh, and yes, that's right, that's right.
He drawn that. He drew that as well, so he's done that a couple times.
Okay, yeah. So good, I'm glad you picked up on that.
Yeah.
So, the second episode, I mean, before we go there, the book that the monitor gives to John Deegan, was there an official name for the book? Was it called The Book of Destiny, or what was it?
Book of Destiny, yeah.
Okay. The second episode acts mainly as a backdoor pilot for Batwoman, in my opinion.
A little. She doesn't get as much showing as I would like. We didn't really see why she became who she was, which you normally do in those kind of situations, but for introducing her and building her hype, I would agree that
But what I'm saying, why I'm saying that is because, like, you don't really get much of the book or anything like that. It's more setting the scene of what Gotham City is, where's Batman, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And so, in that respect, I mean, and because they're giving Batwoman a proper pilot, I knew they were going to go deep into her origins and stuff like that.
Well, you don't want to take away anything for the potential for the pilot.
But what I liked about this episode was that, so for our first mention of Batman, we get a sense of, okay, so Barry is essentially, like Barry, Grant Gustin's Barry, is essentially a Batman fanboy.
Yeah.
Okay. He's fascinated by Batman. Like, he's like one of us. Right.
Yeah.
Oliver is skeptical. He says, "Oh no, that's just a myth that the police are perpetrating to scare criminals." Right. But the cool thing is that he argues when they're saying, "No, he's real." Oliver's argument is like, "No, I was the first vigilante on Earth One." So it's more about jealousy for Oliver.
Oh, 100%. That's exactly where it comes from. That's why he doesn't want to believe that, which eventually he's proven wrong.
So while in Gotham, they get into a fight with some street thugs, and because Barry is Oliver Queen, he gets noticed by the police. They get arrested. Okay. Then they get bailed out, and they're thinking, "Oh, Bruce Wayne bailed us out, right?" But it wasn't Bruce Wayne; it was Kate Kane. Now they they head over to Wayne Enterprises, and I love the fact that they went back to Chicago, because it reminded me so much of Batman Begins in the Dark Knight.
Like, agree.
Wayne Tower was the same tower.
Yeah.
And I love that. Continuity-wise, I loved it. So Kate Kane, basically, when they ask why she bailed them out, she's like, because the sooner you guys find what you want, you'll get out of my city. So she wants nothing really to do with any of this.
No, she wants him out immediately.
And through Kate Kane, we get great explanation of, okay, so Batman's been gone for 3 years.
Yeah, the city's gone to hell.
Yeah.
And Bruce is gone as well.
Yeah, and so it's funny because Supergirl says, but doesn't anybody think it's a coincidence that Bruce and Batman left at the same time?
And she passes it off as Bruce stayed for a little while and
yeah.
he left.
Yeah, she gave him a good cover, I thought.
Yeah, I agree there.
So then she decides, you know, they mention why they're there. So she decides to help them, like track down John Deegan, who the monitor is working with, and he's the one who's rewriting reality. So they track him down to Arkham Asylum. Now, our heroes use Caitlin. They pretend she's a patient to gain access to Arkham Asylum. So once inside, what I liked about it was that, like, you saw the cell doors, and they had some names on them. So you had Oswald Cobblepot. You had Pamela Isley, so Poison Ivy. Right?
Nigma,
so you had the Riddler. Basil Carlo, who's Clayface, right?
Oswald Cobblepot.
Yeah, I said that. We mentioned that one. So I wonder, the fact that they showed those names, if those people are eligible for appearances on Batwoman, what do you think?
I think so. I think that, especially with Gotham ending, it's open book for Batwoman. And I was just wondering if we'll see Nora Freeze on there. Is that going to be something that comes with this little backdoor pilot thing?
Probably, yeah.
That would be pretty cool to know. So, but I enjoyed all the nods there. We got Guggenheim was another person.
Yeah, as an entrepreneur, like one of the producers. Yeah. Which is cool. So one of the cool things was that when Deegan realizes that our heroes are onto him, he releases some of the prisoners from their cells. So what you have is you have chaos inside and some criminals taking advantage, trying to prison break on the outside, right?
Yeah, including Psycho Pirate.
Yeah. So our main Arrowverse heroes are inside trying to curb the chaos. And then Batwoman, you see her big debut on the outside, where I love that she swoops. She uses her, like, grappling gun to swoop some of the criminals that are running away, like, you know, up. That was cool.
And the very Arkham Asylum.
Yeah. And then you see her drop down on that getaway van. Like, she crashes down on the roof.
The Dark Knight van there.
Yeah, she pulls them out of the... Yeah, she pulls them out through the window. That was totally Dark Knight. And then when she throws the batarang at that other criminal, and she knocks him down, that reminded me of Batman 89. Remember when he was on the roof? And those muggers tried to get away, and he used the batarang. That reminded me.
Yeah, I remember that exactly.
So I like the three nods to the three different Batman, you know, forms of media: Arkham, Asylum video games, Dark Knight, and then Batman 89. So back inside, they can't find John Deegan or the book, but you know, Killer Frost runs into, as you mentioned, Nora Freeze, who's using her husband's gun, Freeze gun, which is the same prop from Batman and Robin, I might add, a terrible movie. And she starts, like trying to freeze Killer Frost. So Caitlin radios in the other heroes for help, so they arrive. But then in the chaos, what I assume was fear gas was knocked over.
Yeah, we see a crane. We see a crane written on the...
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden now, we have Flash and Green Arrow standing in front of each other, right? But when they look at each other, they're seeing their nemesis, right? Their greatest nemesis. So Flash is seeing Reverse Flash. Oliver is seeing Malcolm Merlin. And they're fighting each other. And it's this great, like, in tight, hand-to-hand combat kind of thing. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, Batwoman, like, swoops in, takes them both down, and, like, subdues them and sort of gets them straightened out. I thought, like, what a kick-ass moment that was for Batwoman.
Like, yeah, it was a great way to show, like, let her shine.
You're right.
She took down the two title heroes of this universe. Now, they were under Taxon, but still, it was pretty impressive. And we get her basically helping our heroes get out and
they get all the friggin' villains. But the thing that really made me mad was that we didn't get to see any of them. I would have liked to even see the back of one of their uniforms, their prison uniforms, saying their names even.
Yeah.
But I understand where Gotham is on, that I don't think we can see any of them right now.
Yeah, and they want to save that for the Batwoman pilot.
Well, I think that's why, too. Batwoman's not coming out until April as well.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. That was a perfect way to introduce Batwoman.
So,
and that brings us right to the end of the episode. But yeah, I'm curious to hear about your Supergirl and Batwoman thing at the end. I think you love that.
Oh, that was a beautiful moment, because basically what happens is Supergirl uses her X-ray vision, and she realizes that Kid Kane is Batwoman, and I assume by extension realizes that Bruce Wayne is Batman.
I think she knew that part as before, because she, I think, Clark knows on her Earth.
Yeah, but Clark, but yeah, that's true. But it's a different Batman and Superman. Like, in that Earth, it's a different Batman.
That's true too. But maybe she thinks that that's the case.
She figures it's the same on both Earths. Yeah.
Yeah.
So she tells Kate, "Your cousin would be proud of you," and then she goes, "It's a shame that I have to leave. I think we'd make a great team." And Batwoman says, "World's finest," and they shake hands.
Setting us up for future crossovers that we will no doubtably get.
Yeah, as a fan of Batman and Superman, specifically in the comic books written by Jeff Loeb, and in the animated series, you know, World's Finest Crossover, I was grinning from ear to ear as if I was a Joker. I wasn't laughing hysterically, but, you know, that made me so happy.
I'll agree. I love that as well. That was great, and a great way to end off the episode.
Yeah. So now, at the tail end of that episode, though, Earth 90, Barry Allen breaches through. Right?
Yeah.
He says that, "I'm Barry Allen of and I'm the Flash of Earth 90." And then he basically tells them that what the Monitor did to his Earth. And we see all the heroes walking together. You know, Supergirl, Barry, Oliver, and
Superman.
No, Superman wasn't there at this point.
No, yeah.
The Flash. John was the Egyptian Flash. So they're all confronting the Monitor, and the Monitor basically takes the book back, tells them that this is a test to see if they're prepared for a greater threat to come. He apparently zaps the Flash back to Earth 90, zaps Supergirl God knows where at this point, and so we're left wondering what's going on. At the beginning of part 3, we, like, you see him give the book to John Deegan, and he says, "I need you to think bigger, become a god," right? So John Deegan makes himself into Superman, you know, and so the Superman in the black costume is John Deegan, right? And he's basically, what I think he set up is Earth 1, where he's a totalitarian, right? Supergirl's imprisoned in the DEO. All the DEO people, you know, work at Superman's beck and call. Oliver and Barry are criminals on this Earth, right? And so, like you mentioned that it was your least favorite of the episodes, the part 3, right?
Maybe yes. Like, part 1 was, if it was a standalone crossover, I would have loved it. And I did like part 3. It just started to slow down a little bit.
Yeah, no, it did slow down a little bit. Like, here's the stuff I liked about it. Because what happens is, Barry and Oliver breached Earth 38 to the fortress and basically retrieve Superman and Lois. Well, Superman, but Lois ends up finding her way there too.
Yeah.
And so there's a very cool fight between evil Superman, black suit Superman, and actual Superman. And I love the fight. It was very reminiscent to Man of Steel, the way how they fought in the air. They were fighting through buildings. But, and you know I love Man of Steel, but I think what this fight did well was not going overboard with the using, you know, like they weren't using buildings as turnbuckles. Like, it didn't look like a WWF match, right?
Well, like you said before, this Superman is a seasoned veteran, so he's gonna prevent all that stuff better than Superman on his first weekend.
Yeah, and you see that, and you see that difference.
Yeah.
And what I liked about it too, so not only do you get the Superman versus Superman fight, but John Deegan as evil black suited Superman and being a tyrant gives you a little hint of Injustice, Gods Among Us flavor to this crossover.
I was hoping that he was just going to do that anyway and not have him just take Superman from this earth and kill Lois and make him go this way.
Yeah.
But still, you get the end result anyway, like you said. So I enjoyed that a lot as well.
Yeah. And so eventually, you know, Kara convinces That World's Alex to help her get loose. And Barry helps her out. Superman manages to get control of the book long enough to sort of rewrite reality enough so that Barry is in Flash and Oliver is Arrow again. And so Barry and Supergirl concoct this plan where Superman will distract John Deegan enough while Supergirl and Barry run around the Earth, like on opposite ends, in effect slowing time down, which would give Superman a chance to get the book, and Oliver would be able to fire an arrow at John Deegan, right?
Yeah.
But the problem with that is Superman saw how this plan would play out when he had control of the book, and he said, you guys are going to die if you do that. So, but, you know, Supergirl and the Flash being heroes are willing to take the risk. So they start doing their thing. Superman goes off to distract John Deegan. And Oliver decides to pull a 180 and makes a deal with the Monitor. We don't know what that deal is, but, you know, he makes a deal to go save, so, to make sure that Kara and the Flash would live. Right? They do. So now, usually when you make a deal like that, there has to be one life for another, right? So the deal between the two were unspoken. But I think Oliver offered to sacrifice himself at a later date. So we'll get to that in a second. When we saw the visual of Flash and Supergirl running around the Earth, that was clearly a nod to Superman the movie, right?
Oh, yeah, I've seen a clip there today. It looks just like it, except there's no red flash. There's only a blue light. So, yeah, it's just like it.
And I didn't, you know what? I didn't mind that plot point.
No, same here. It's no big deal. This is CW.
And you know what? The fact that it all worked out according to plan when Oliver made that whatever deal that was, I'm fine with that.
Oh, yeah. I'm thinking along your lines, but I just don't know if the writers would make it that easy. Like maybe Oliver tried to enact this deal and Barry stops it. Who knows? We'll find out going forward.
So everything works out as normal. But I do have a couple problems with the episode. Okay. And you do, and I think you do too.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong. One of the things you're disappointed on is John Wesley Shipp. We barely saw him.
Yeah, I didn't like that. They built it up. They teased it and built up that he was going to be there for a really long time. And we got barely anything.
Like, we got that montage at the beginning, which we saw three times before last
week. I've seen that about 17 times. It was not every episode.
yeah. And then he breaches through. And then he has that big stare down. You know, that Western movie-style stare down. In the middle of the street. And then he gets zapped away. And there's no mention of if when our heroes, you know, rewrote time, if that saved Earth 90. There's no mention of that. So we don't know if how, like, his fate.
Nope.
So we both share that problem. Now, I liked the very end scene with Superman, which we'll talk about.
Same here. I enjoyed all the scenes. It's just one little bit of one aspect of dialogue I didn't enjoy.
It was the dialogue between him and Supergirl at the end, correct?
Yes, he could have.
So what's your issue? Tell us.
Tell
us your issue. Why is that an issue for you?
He basically depowers himself yet again, saying, "You're stronger than I ever was. You handle crisis better than I ever was." And Lois pipes in with the, statistically, women are better at handling crisis. I didn't need any of that. All I needed Superman to say was something along the lines of, "I'm proud of you, Kara. You've come quite far in your abilities. I feel really comfortable about leaving the Earth in your capable hands while I go to Argo."
Yeah.
You'll represent the House of El and that shield with pride or something like that. That's all you need to say. You don't need to put down Superman.
You're 100% right. Like the aspect of him saying, like, it's the fact that he says, "You're stronger than me." Like, he flat out says, "You're better than me." And then he says, "Well, as long as Supergirl's on Earth, it doesn't need Superman." Like, and they've done this. This is the one aspect of Superman's appearance on Supergirl that I absolutely can't stand, because they've done this before, that in order to prop up Superman...
They put... prop up Supergirl, they put down Superman.
Yeah, exactly. In order to prop up Supergirl, they have to kick Superman down a couple notches. And you don't need to do that.
No, not at all.
The comics don't do it.
No.
The animation never did it. So why should this do it? I think it's ridiculous. And that dialogue felt so forced and so nauseating that... And then my thing was, how could you get it so right where she, in the first part, where she looks up to him and she seeks his advice because he's a more seasoned hero about the whole secret identity thing. And then you go and do this?
Yeah, you totally just ruined... If you would have just changed it, like I said, the way I said, like, you could do some different thing, obviously a way better way of writing that. But something along those lines, you could have easily avoided anything like this.
But then they sort of right the ship by having a scene in the fortress.
Oh, that was a fantastic...
Oh, by the way, they reveal that Lois Lane is pregnant, and this is why she's going to Argo. To have a safe pregnancy away from, any danger or whatnot. So in the fortress, it's very much a homage to Superman, the scene in Superman 2, where they have their date in the fortress. Yeah. Superman's cooking and blah, blah, blah. She's wearing a similar outfit to what Margot Kidder wore. And so Superman fashions a wedding ring, a diamond out of coal. And he proposes to her. And of course, she says yes. And the cool thing about this is that slowly, Supergirl's iteration of Superman is lining up with the comics.
Yeah.
Lois is going to have a baby. Hopefully, they'll name him John. And hopefully, Superman will indeed get a spinoff, and it'll involve John Kent Superboy. That's what I'm hoping. Because I don't buy that he said, "I'm leaving," and that closes the door to a show. I think all that does is set a stage for what the show would deal with if and when it happens. And I think...
Just like Batgirl, my friend. Yeah. Just like Batgirl.
Batwoman. Yeah.
Batgirl, yeah. I keep saying that. I'll be saying that until, I'd say, season 3 of Batwoman.
Yeah. So no, I think, because I think, and so that was a great ending. I love that ending. So it kind of made up for that debacle of dialogue in between.
I'll agree with you there.
And then another end of the episode is that Kate Kane calls Oliver and says, "I think your doctor Deegan's going to be a problem." And Oliver goes, "Why?" He said, "Well, he's making friends in Arkham." And then you see in Arkham, John Deegan, and in the cell beside him, Psycho Pirate, saying, "Don't worry, my friend, plans are in motion. You know, a crisis is coming, worlds will die."
Yeah, like the famous line from Crisis.
Yeah, and then the episode ends with a title card flashing across the screen, coming in fall 2019.
Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Right, so that's what's going to be the adaptation. So briefly, and then we'll rate the episode and we'll finish up here. But I want to tell you my theory. I have two theories of how this is going to go. Either Oliver is going to be the one to sacrifice himself in crisis.
Yeah.
Sort of, which will be the... So, here's the scenarios I see. If Oliver sacrifices himself in crisis, I think Green Arrow will be renewed for one more season, for a shorter season, with the finale culminating during the crisis event. So Oliver will sacrifice himself in the finale and then end Arrow. Okay? That's one possibility. The other possibility, you got to remember that we have a Supergirl movie in development and a Flash movie. Warner Brothers has the rules of we can't have the same actor who's, or the same character who's getting a movie having a show, right?
Yeah.
If Supergirl and The Flash are both getting movies, the other option I could see happening is both The Flash gets renewed for a shorter run, Supergirl gets renewed for a shorter run. Both finales culminate The Flash keeps going at a regular run. Supergirl gets a shorter run. So, in the Crisis on Infinite Earths, I think Barry Allen will get lost in the crisis, forcing Wally to come back and take over. Because from Warner Brothers' perspective, you can still have The Flash on TV. It just can't be Barry Allen.
You can do it like that, but you might have to recast Wally, because it doesn't seem like Keenan Lonsdale wants to have a permanent role on one of these shows.
I think it was more that he wasn't getting screen time, that's why.
Could be that too, yeah, we don't know. It all depends on actor availability, but I really like that second theory of yours.
And then the other part of that theory is that, okay, so Supergirl, right? In Crisis, in the book, she dies.
Yeah.
Right? So what I think is going to happen, it's part of the Flash scenario, is that Supergirl will die. The Earths will merge into one, and the finale of Supergirl, which will culminate in one of the Crisis episodes, in the final Crisis episode, will set a transition for a Superman show. Because remember that line of cringy dialogue that said, "As long as there's a Supergirl, the world doesn't need Superman."
That could be true, my friend. That's a good point.
If Supergirl dies in Crisis, there's no longer a Supergirl. Ergo, Superman is needed.
I don't know if that's something that the CW would do. That seems pretty jarring, but it seems more like a DC Universe type thing. But no, I really like the sound of that.
The reason why I think it might happen is because, like I said, Warner Brothers seemingly has that mandate that when a movie for one character is guaranteed to be happening, they cannot be on television at the same time. So that's what I think is going to happen.
That could be.
I could be totally wrong. But those are just my theories, but I can't wait till next season's
crossover. I agree with you. I can't wait till next season. So and your theories are pretty interesting.
So let's wrap this up for now. And then give our ratings for this crossover.
I give this...
Let's rate it as a whole. Like one.
Okay, a whole? Yeah, that episode's just a whole. Yeah, you got it. Okay, I give this a 4.5 out of 5, and it just falls under Crisis on Earth X for me.
As I was watching it, it was going along at an A+, perfect score.
Yeah.
But the combination of the lack of John Wesley Shipp as Barry Allen and that cringy segment of dialogue between Superman and Supergirl knocked it down to an A.
Ooh. Nice.
So, still great, but...
Oh, yeah, still great crossover. I really enjoyed it, and a lot of fan service for all of us who have been watching the DCCW for so many years.
But I can't wait for next week.
Oh,
Not for next week. For next year.
Hopefully now, with next year's crossover, it'll be a story that we can watch this crossover and the next crossover back to back in one big miniseries.
Oh, that's a great plan.
Yeah, I hope they do something along those lines where you can just pick up from this crossover and go on, because it would be a great little miniseries that you could do sell it on DVD.
Sign me up. I'm down for that.
Awesome, buddy.
But that'll bring this episode to a close. We love the crossover.
Yeah.
And we hope you did too. Travis, where, by the way, we are part of the Batman Podcast Network, so I want to give a shout out to that. Find more awesome podcasts on that network. But Travis, in terms of social media, if our listeners want to talk more about the crossover with you or any of this news, where can they do that?
You can find me on Twitter at Travis_156. You can drop me a line. We can chat DC or pretty much anything. Any thoughts on this crossover, I'd love to hear it. I did an extra podcast with the DC drop on this after my first viewing, and my thoughts changed a little bit after a second viewing. It kind of dropped under Crisis for me after a second viewing, so it was pretty cool. It's a little thoughts after one watching and thoughts after two. So I thought that was a pretty cool thing. And Superhero Discussions is a little side solo podcast that I do from time to time. That doesn't stick in DC. That's pretty much anything. So, yeah, those are all the places that you can find me.
And if you want to talk with me, you can do so at the Multiverse Musings Facebook page or on Twitter. And my Twitter handle for that is at Superhero Sci-Fi. Before we leave you, we want to wish all our listeners a Merry Christmas. And we will be back with you just before the new year for another episode. Probably it'll be the Aquaman episode, Aquaman review.
Yeah.
But until then, have a Merry Christmas.
Happy holidays, you guys.
Yeah, happy holidays. Enjoy your families. Enjoy your friends. And we'll be back next week with our thoughts on Aquaman. But until you're here listening to that, we hope you have a wonderful week, a wonderful weekend, and a wonderful Christmas. So long, everybody.
So long, guys.